I'm Genevieve, I'm an alcoholic. Great to be here, and I don't think I've ever heard the steps in the tradition. Where'd they go? That was like a pep rally. My sobriety date is December the 8th, 2012. I have a home group. I was in Atlanta when they asked me to come and be like the local person, the local rep. I'm supposed to have like a local person. Then I moved to North Carolina, and I called Amy, and I was like, hey, well, not Georgia anymore. And she said, oh, girl, you're Southeast. Come on down. I was like, okay. My home group is Women of Courage, Asheville, North Carolina, Saturday morning. And I tell you, I am a baby in sobriety there. I still consider myself a baby, but I walked into that room, and you can't spit without hitting a woman 40 years in that group. And it's big, but we also get a ton of newcomers. So that, to me, is a healthy group. We've got lots of newcomers coming in and staying. We've got lots of people with 40 years who are still committed to AA. My sponsor has 30-something years, and she says, and when she speaks, I do more in AA now than I did when I came in. And I'm only coming up on 10 years, but that is true for me. I do more in AA now than I did when I came in. And I do it, Dr. Bob's four reasons at the end of his story mean a lot to me. It's paying back my debt. It's insurance. It's a joy. It's a joy. I'm kind of forgetting the fourth one right now, but I got three out of four of Dr. Bob's reasons for how he sponsored, and he was just a lion of sponsorship. I originally come to New York City. My parents were in the book business, and they raised me. You know, in the book it says, when we tell our stories, we talk about how we formed a relationship with God. And so that was how I was kind of brought up to tell my story. And we didn't have a religious household at all. They had fled the church, both my parents, and they were determined. They didn't have good experiences in the church growing up. They were determined not to lead me and my sister in any way. They wanted us to find our own way. But they worshiped things. They were worshipers. And when I read in We Agnostics, we were worshipers, we had to admit we were worshipers, that was real, got real clear to me that it may not have been God and an altar or any signs of Christianity in my household, but they worshipped achievement. They worshipped what people thought of you. They worshipped, I like to call it our Holy Trinity, the New York Times, NPR, and PBS. That was like what my parents did, and, you know, they treated it like worship. That's the first thing they did when they woke up, turn on the news, get a paper, read the paper. There was no getting on my knees in the household, no meditation, none of that. And the last thing they did was, look at PBS or something before going to bed. So it was the pattern of their days, and so I didn't grow up with a God. Those were my gods. And what did your teacher say about you was my God from the very beginning? And alcoholism is all over my dad's side of the family. He brought it to the family, but he didn't have it. He was a classic Al-Anon, and unrecovered to this day, Al-Anon. And I tell you, my sister and I, our runs lasted a lot longer than they might have because of my parents. Because when I got in trouble, I had a phone call I could make. And I was bailed out of more situations. More things were paid off on my behalf. I was sent to more places with their money because I couldn't support myself. So God bless Al-Anon. I mean, saving lives of people like me, you know, earlier, getting us in here earlier. Drinking was just what the adults did in my house. You know, it was just something, it was sophisticated. Adults, they would have dinner parties. They would talk about lights would go down. Some paella would be served and they'd be drinking. It didn't look scary in my household at all. Now, my cousins' households did get a little scary. And my cousins, they're all older than me, most of them older than me, they went down faster than I did. I thank God today, almost every one of my cousins is in AA. Or a recovery program. There's only one that's still out there. Only one cousin is still out there, and he still makes it to the family reunions. And he was my favorite cousin growing up. God, he was good looking and talented. And I just worshiped him. He's older than me, but you know, he went down the alcoholic tubes like we do. And now he's kind of a shut-in. You know, his teeth aren't in good shape. He's lost people left and right. He doesn't have a relationship. But he still comes to the family reunions, and, you know, we're keeping a seat for him. Nobody's trying to 12-step him. He knows all of us are in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we used to have family reunions and be loud and obnoxious because we were drunk. But now we have family reunions, and we're loud and joyful because we're sober. And we're sober together. So I was the second-to-last cousin in. But I am a little younger, so I'll give myself that. My sister was the final cousin in to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't believe the relationship my sister and I have now. We are 6 years apart, and we fought like cats. And now that we're sober, we have something new and beautiful that I didn't think was possible. I probably started messing with the liquor cabinet around 7 years old. It wasn't locked. Opened it. It had all sorts of bottles. It smelled strange. I thought it looked like the Emerald City. And, you know, I was an unhappy little kid. Way before I started drinking, there was no reason for me to be unhappy. It was just something I was born with. I just came out like we heard every speaker has talked about it so far. It just did not fit. I just did not fit. My parents didn't know what to do. I was so angry. They sent me to therapy when I was 7 years old. And I decided I wasn't going to say a word to that therapist, and I didn't. I didn't say a word for a year. That therapist. I had a little bottle of sugar pills. I shook the whole time like some little psycho kid. And she was finally like, I give up. Nobody knew I had alcoholism when I was 7. I was undiagnosed. I wasn't even drinking regularly yet. I was getting into the liquor cabinet and clearing my sinuses out. But I couldn't get enough in me then when I was 7 to fall over or, you know, crawl under a table or something. It was just, I would go take little nips and then, you know, fill the water. And I didn't know what was happening to me or why I was attracted to it, but I was. I was just attracted to it like a moth to a flame. But they sent me to therapy, and I know now if you had could have gotten a few drinks in me that weren't so strong, like in the liquor cabinet, like if you could have given me, when I was 7, wine, a few glasses of wine or something, I would have been a different kid. You would have seen a personality change. I know that now. And back then, I'm 48 years old now, and back then they just didn't have the medications for kids that they do now. I would sure be medicated if I were born now and I had the troubles I had when I was 7. They just didn't have, they didn't know what to do, you know. I didn't start in high school. I had my first sort of whoa, allergy of the body moment. Of course, I didn't have that language. You know, I didn't know what an allergy of the body was, but I threw a party, and I remember a couple people at that party at my house. I don't remember everybody else, but boy, do I remember what that wine cooler looked like, the exact way the bottle looked, the exact sheen of the label, the artificial color of the actual alcohol. I remember exactly what it looked like because I was already looking at alcohol more than I was looking at people. And I, you know, blacked out at my own party, crawled around the house, vomited, you know, the things that made a total fool out of myself. And I woke up sick as a dog, got caught, got busted, got grounded. But you know what our minds do, because I had tasted freedom that night. I had been set free. I was able to play with my friends. Before I went crawling, I was able to play. I apparently had a great time before I was crawling around the house. And so what was my conclusion at the end of that night? My conclusion was, don't get caught. That's an alcoholic mind. That's an alcoholic mind. Because I know people who are like, oh, I'm drinking a little too much, I'm putting on a little weight, or my head's not clear, or I have this big... And they just modify. I mean, they just moderate. They're just like, yeah, this is not working for me, and that is it's not the way it went for me. My mind would go down corridors of rationalizations and defenses, everything it could to protect the right to drink for me. And that went on until I was brought to my knees. I went to a hard drinking college. I found the hardest drinking people. Alcohol was already making decisions for me. I didn't even know it. Chose my major because I just chose something that came natural and I was good at. I didn't particularly like it, but someone gave me some compliments. I got a few A's. That's my major. You know, that's the amount of, because all I'm thinking about is where's the next keg, you know. I had the chance to play a sport with some real prestige in college. No, I'm going to go play rugby because they drink all the time. They're drinking before games. They're drinking after games. They're drinking the night before. They're drinking with the other team. They're drinking out of their shoes. They're drinking, I mean, we did drink out of our shoes. There was something called shoot the boot, and you would take off your rugby cleat, and you would fill it, and you would drink. I mean, that's charming. You know, yeah. Alcoholism brought me to some very charming, charming places. But, you know, the thing about my disease is that it is progression, and it progressed in me. I was not a constant fall-down drinker when I started, and I wasn't that way for years. I didn't wake up in Tennessee, you know, like some of us do. Some of us have the allergy well-developed right at the beginning, first drink. And that's a hard road. For me, there were nights I could control it. There were nights I said no thanks. There were nights I was like, I've got a big paper due. It's progressive. It's insidious. It's sneaky. And what it did over the years, you know, I didn't get sober till my 30s, is it just gradually sliced off pieces of my life. Almost like I didn't notice they were going. You know, like an old friend would be kind of like, hey, you haven't really been in touch. You know, you haven't really asked me about me. You haven't really shown up as a friend. And maybe they wouldn't dump me as a friend right there, but they just kind of would like leave my life, and I'd be like, where'd they go? Where'd they go? You know, or a job just wouldn't work out. I wasn't drunk and vomiting on the job. I just had my own way. I was going to do it my own way. You know, the alcoholic personality was really being formed in me, the self-centeredness that absolutely kills us. First, it cuts us off from other people, so we can't form the 12 and 12, I think. It says we're incapable of forming a true partnership with people. And when I read that line, my heart just broke, and I said, God, yes. I didn't take a single friend from grade school, high school, or college. Not a single friend that was I able to stay with and maintain a relationship, because I could not see past my own self-centeredness, my own self-pity, my own self-absorption. It was all about me all the time. And I thought I was tons of fun and interesting and smart and, you know, could tell a good joke and, well, the party starts when I walk in the door. That's what I thought. And that was not what was happening. That was not what was happening. That's a sad, you know, that's a sad life. I never went to jail. I never had to be professionally detoxed. There was one time when I should have been. But alcoholism was slicing off my life at the margins, and it was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And, you know, a lot of us die that way, too. We don't, some of us say, One of my cousins said, you know, I drink and I go to town. You know, start drinking, they go out. It's time to go out. I drink and I went in. I went in. And another one of my cousins said, you know, she was talking to me and she said, you know, when I came out as an alcoholic, no one could believe it. She said, well, you only had a couple drinks out at the bar. And she said, you didn't see me go home and finish the job. And I thought, uh-huh. That's right, because it was alone in my house, either before I went out drinking or after, where I finished the job, and talking to people who weren't there in my head, having relationships with people who weren't around in my head, just because the primary relationship in my life had become alcohol. And alcoholism did everything it could to convince me that wasn't the case. And, y'all, I knew I was wrong inside. I knew something was missing. I felt the big, hollowed place a lot of us talk about, where the wind was just whistling through my heart. And I need to be healed. I need to be made whole. I don't know what. I tried therapy. I'm a depressive. Like Bill Wilson was a depressive. And alcohol for years lifted me up. Had me come out and play. Had me come out and party. Lifted me from the depression. For years it worked. I heard somewhere, and I agree, that for me, this is true, for me, there are two great solutions for alcoholism in my life. The first one is here in AA and God, Alcoholics Anonymous. The second is alcohol. And it was a solution for about 18 years for me. It treated the disease of alcoholism successfully for me. And I managed not to get into car wrecks, although I drove drunk. And I managed, my body held out. I had physical problems when I came in because of the drinking, but I was able to repair those in a few years. My body came back, so my body held out. I didn't crash my car. And I did commit some crimes, but I wasn't caught. And I was able to make amends for those when I got sober. So one of the speakers said, a lot of people are protected. You know, there are reasons why some of us are protected. And I had those reasons. I had a family. They had money to save me. I had an education. And, you know, I was surrounded by those things. They protected me. And since I didn't get into a wreck and I wasn't ever pulled over and so it can go on a long time. If you have those things protecting you, it can go on a really long time, you know, or you can just take your life, which started to be an option at the end. It started to be an option for me at the end. But boy, I tried all sorts of things to get right. I had years in the Buddhist community. I was a Zen Buddhist. We meditated all the time and sewed these robes and I had a name and, a Japanese type name and I had a Roshi and I did all that for a while. And I tell you, that was very helpful though. I'm not in that community anymore, but to meditate, to sit on a cushion and try to look at your mind over and over again, alcoholism lives in the mind. Allergy of the body. But it lives in the mind. The mind is what's going to kill me. If I just had the allergy, just don't pick up a drink. Great. Just say no. Don't pick up a drink. You're alive. But I have the obsession, which dooms me to pick up a drink. The allergy dooms me to keeping going. Now I'm going to drink again, drink more. And that cycle is what kills us. That's the alcoholic problem that was taught to me when I came in. I've got an obsession of the mind, an allergy of the body, taught by the doctor's opinion. So, no, I just completely lost my place on that one. Don't even know what I was talking about. No, that's okay. We'll get there. We'll get sober, won't we? We'll get sober. Oh, yeah. So I did a lot of things, a lot of self-help, a lot of therapies. And I would have moments where I was kind of lifted out. I never stopped drinking, and the drinking was getting worse. But I had moments when I was lifted out of that place of the uselessness and the futility of life. Who read the Bedevilments like I did and thought, oh, my goodness, there's no way around these. When I read the Bedevilments in the big book, and I was reading Bill's story, I was reading the big book, I was testing it out on myself, because that's that whole step one, all those chapters are about testing it out on myself. Am I now, this is me. And Bill wasn't about to force this to be me. You know, put down the book, walk away if you're not an alcoholic, if this isn't you. And so I was testing out Bill's story, stock speculator, you know, like kind of a, you know, certain type of guy mentality. He's a man. He's this old fashioned. But when I got to the Bedevilments, I was like, uh-oh. Every one of those was true for me. And then when I got to the qualification, if when you honestly want to, you find you can't stop, you know, entirely, or, you know, the qualification we do with folks, you know, that just says basically what you're saying is I got the allergy and the obsession. When I got to those two things, I was pinned against a wall. I thought, oh, what was happening to me when I was searching in all those spiritual groups and self-help and I'm doing a retreat here and I was quietly being surrounded by members of Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't even know it. I was in one group that was doing a kind of breathing therapy called rebirthing, which was super helpful for lots of healing of childhood stuff. And then I would go drink again. You know, I'd be kind of high from the breathing and then go drink again. It just was never enough. It just was never enough. Whatever spiritual new little high I had reached, I needed to go get the bottle to. The 12 and 12 is clear on this, too. It's not just when times are bad. It's also when I'm rolling double sixes. You know, I'm on a high. I'm on a roll. I want more. Let's keep that going. So anxiety, depression, excitement, the 12 and 12 says those were my three states of being. And drinking fits with all of those for a long time, right? So I was quietly being surrounded by people in AA, and I got into therapy with a woman who was sober. I knew she was sober. She had that thing in her eyes. I didn't talk to her about my drinking, really. I talked to her about everything else in therapy. She had over 20 years, and it was in Atlanta. And she was just waiting. She was just waiting for me. And I stuck it out with therapy, and I had little breakthroughs. You know, I spent so many years, y'all, sitting on a couch trying to figure out why I felt the way I did. And therapy is such a blessing. And right now I'm not in therapy. I'm so grateful it's there for me if I need it. But for me, depression was a misdiagnosis. That's not everybody's story. I know that. But for me, I had alcoholism. And when I started to treat for alcoholism, the depression lifted. Thank God therapy and medication are there for me if I need it again. Because since I know I'm a person who might be capable of taking her own life, I know God works through doctors. God works through medicine. So thank goodness it's there for us, for all of us, for me, if I need it. But for me, it was a misdiagnosis. So thank God I got the treatment I needed here in Alcoholics Anonymous for alcoholism. So somebody came up to me the other day and was like, boy, I hope your story has some gory details in it, and it's explicit, and, you know, I love it when women tell those gory details. And I was like, No, you're not going to hear that from the podium. It's like, you can go to the internet and look that stuff up. But let me tell you, they happened to me. I became what I call a creature. I became a creature as a Jekyll and Hyde situation. I got into a relationship, a final relationship that brought me to lows that I thought that I wouldn't go to. I allowed things to be done to me that I don't look at with shame anymore, because AA has healed that. I'm not a bad person trying to get good. I'm a sick person trying to get well. I'm a recovered person. And what did you recover from? A hopeless state of mind and body, and a lot of terrible things that you let happen to you and that you did. The drinking was out of control. I was drinking stronger and stronger stuff. At the end, it was just tequila. And then it was just tequila right from the bottle. And I let those things happen to me. And I became, and I think this happens to a lot of people, the distance between the person that I hoped I was and wanted to be and the person who I actually was became too far apart. I couldn't bridge the gap anymore by taking a few drinks or a few rationalizations or an explanation, or couldn't bridge the gap anymore. The creature was too far from the vision of what I'd wanted to be, and that's a dangerous, dangerous place, because not being able to bridge the gap didn't leave me a lot of options. I wasn't in AA yet. I didn't know you could have a personality change. I didn't know you could have a psychic change. I'd been trying for a spiritual experience, you know, that's why I did drugs and all those other things, spiritual experience. You know, I'd been trying for that for so long. I didn't know that AA had a transformative power that could shrink that gap and could probably even change the view of what I was and what I'd become. I was sick. I wasn't just a degraded person. But I wasn't, that was a place where I started thinking about taking my own life, like a lot of us do, and a lot of us try to take our own lives, and a lot of us succeed in taking our own lives. And luckily, my last best idea failed. Thank goodness when our last best idea fails, and there's nowhere else to go. And I had an evening where, like many evenings before, I was powerless over alcohol, but I hadn't seen it yet. But I had a day where all the alcoholic pieces came together, and somehow God granted me the ability to see it. I woke up in the morning and I begged myself not to drink. I begged the person I was with to keep me from drinking. And then what happens? Parallel to our sane thinking runs the insane idea that maybe it's not going to be like that tonight. So suddenly, I'm asking for a drink. How'd that happen? It's because alcoholism lives in the mind. Someone was making me a drink. I'm having my drink. I'm finishing their drink when they go to the bathroom because I know the drinking's over, but I'm not over. I just started drinking. The allergy's taking over. Now when no one's looking, I'm huddled over the bottle trying to get it into my mouth, and the thought comes to me. It was implanted in my mind. It wasn't a voice. This is an alcoholic. Not you are an alcoholic. But somehow the impersonal wording of that, almost like the third person or once removed, I don't know, this is an alcoholic. That worked for me. That worked. Now, it didn't stop me from taking the drink because the hand does what it's going to do. I mean, how many of us have just driven to the liquor? The car just drove to the liquor store. And I've heard this thing about the people's hands. I thought I was insane. The hand went for the bottle, and I was begging the hand not to go for the bottle. Please don't pick up that bottle, hand, as if it were like Little Shop of Horrors or something like that. But it was my hand that I couldn't keep from bringing the bottle to my lips. I didn't stop drinking that night, but that was the bottom. It was the most degraded, and I let things happen to me that night, and I woke up the next morning, and I felt dead inside. I felt absolutely dead inside. And luckily, that relationship fell to pieces shortly after that, and my last best idea failed, and the curtains were pulled back on my life, and I found myself on my living room floor, and I took step one backwards. I wasn't ready to say I was powerless over alcohol, but boy, did I know my life was unmanageable. I didn't have a job at that point. My friends had jumped ship. I was out of money. My last relationship was over, and I could not stop drinking. I was being entirely propped up by my parents, and that's the only way I still had a home. I took step one backwards. My life is unmanageable. You remember that scene in the book where the stock market crashes and Bill goes to the bar and he's hopeless, he's out of ideas, but then the old fight comes back? That happened to me. After a beautiful moment of grace and surrender on my living room floor where I knew my life was unmanageable, but out of my mouth, out loud came the words, I have got to stop drinking. So that was God, because I wasn't thinking about drinking right then. I was thinking about my unmanageable life. But God put the words, I have got to stop drinking, out in the air. Oh, I decided, well, I'll show them. I'll take 30 days off. So I did take 30 days off. It was rough. But the day I was supposed to start drinking again, and y'all, I cannot remember what happened. I went to a meeting instead. I don't remember the moment when I didn't go to the liquor store. I went to a meeting instead. I mean, thank God I don't have to understand this, right? I don't know what that was. I mean, I do know what that was. But I wouldn't know how to get it back. It was grace. It was undeserved. I hadn't earned that. My hair cutter had 12-stepped me. She was in AA, and she had very skillfully 12-stepped me and said, you know, the door's always open. Come to my home group. Check it out. There are kind of people. I have no idea what that means. I think it means alcoholics, because I walked in, and it was a room of alcoholics. So it's our kind of people. And I walked in there my first day. I wasn't ready to say I was an alcoholic. I didn't even know what an alcoholic was. But I knew that just a desire to stop drinking. I was smart. I had read The Wall. I get The Wall. I saw the tradition, desire to stop drinking. So I walked in, and you guys welcomed me. It was a full, alive, awake meeting. I remember absolutely nothing except see the similarities, not the differences. I had some kind of crazy smile pasted onto my face because I didn't want you to see what was happening inside me. And I was thinking about taking my own life, and I couldn't stop drinking. I was hoping. I hated myself. Didn't want you to see that. So I had some creepy smile on my face. I hope it wasn't like the horror movie smile that's out now, or that people say it's super creepy. And a woman came up to me afterwards, handed me a big book. And that was my first big book. And I will never forget that woman, and I try to do that intermittently for women too, to bring them a big book. And I went to my therapist the next time. I said, I need help. Let's get real. I didn't say alcoholic. I said, I can't stop drinking. I need help. And she looked at me and she said, honey, I'm no longer your therapist. I am now your sponsor. And we got going for real. All the help she tried to give me from her heart, because she was a heart-based person, cannot touch the disease of alcoholism. until I'm ready to be brought to my knees. And I was on my knees. And she said, we do the steps quickly. We study the book for a lifetime. So I thought, okay, that's what we're doing. And she said, let's go to this Joe and Charlie book study. And I think Billy talked about this with the highlighters. Everyone and Joe, I had two highlighters in there. I had blue and yellow. And I had pens too. And I sat in the first, second, or third row. Because that's what my sponsor did, and that's what she told me to do. But y'all, I really wanted it. I really, really wanted to be lifted from where I was, because a depressed life, a crippling depression is a hard way to go. That is a hard way to live, and the alcohol was not working anymore. At the end, it made the depression worse. At the end, it was fits of rage. At the end, it was leaving my own parties to cry in a corner. At the end, it was acting out and all sorts of things. But the main thing is, the outside consequences don't look like a lot to me. We had our wonderful speaker just say he spent 27 years in prison. That's not my story. My prison was inside. It was inside my heart and my chest, and that's a bad prison to not be able to live with yourself, to hate yourself. You're walking around free, but you're not free. You're not free when you're walking around with active alcoholism. So we got going, and I stayed in that Joe and Charlie study for about 3 years. We went through the book, I think, 3 times. So I got a lot of history. I got a lot of hope. It was, AA has pockets of enthusiasm, I was taught. AA, every meeting, there's probably something wonderful in every meeting. Two alcoholics coming together, try to get better. But there are pockets of enthusiasm, and I was told, find those pockets. This is one of them. People coming together to love AA. The music of AA in that lobby, I mean, you can hear it, right? You go, I just stood there on the fringes of it last night listening to everyone talk to each other. The music of AA. I love to go to meetings when I travel. You spend half an hour wandering around a church, you know, not knowing where you're going. You're wandering in. There's like people playing bells in one room. There's like knitting in another room. And finally you hear those voices. And that's the AA meeting. It's the language of the heart. It's the people talking to each other, the joy of recovery together. And then you start going through the church real fast because you know where the meeting is. You know where the meeting is. And that's what that meeting had, the Joe and Charlie study. You know, it was 100, 200 people. There was a lot of power in that room. We all did the third step on our knees together. That was, you know, I'm not from a Christian background, but I was willing. I was willing to get on my knees. I was willing to do whatever it takes to get me out of this terrible head that I have on my shoulders and the hand that reaches for the bottle. Please save me from that life. I do not want more of my life to be sliced away. I want to live. I want to be free. I want to be free of alcoholism. So I was willing, and I did the steps like my life depended on them, and I did them quickly, and we got to step 12, and we did it on our knees together, and my sponsor looked at me, and she said, are you ready to sponsor? And I, you know, you don't say no. So I was like, yes. And out of nowhere, within 15 minutes, some girl came, I'd never even met her, and she said, will you be my sponsor? And I was like, what? And then I tried to talk her out of it. Because I was like, I just finished the steps, and you don't, are you sure? And you know, I don't even know. And she wouldn't take no for an answer. So I've heard that if you start sponsoring in your first year, it's a little easier to keep sponsoring, I've heard. And if you take a little longer, it's a little harder to keep sponsoring. I haven't seen the data on that, but my sponsor was clear that she's taking me through the steps so I can turn around and take women through the steps. She was clear on that from the very beginning, and I'm clear with my sponsees about that now. We're not doing this. We're doing this for the flow. It doesn't stop at you. The river of recovery doesn't stop at you. You're going to further that river. You're going to further that flow. And that's how this is going to work, because your head's going to pop out of your butt. I don't say anything like that, but that's what's going to happen if you try to sit down with another woman. And every time a sponsee calls me for the first time, and they're talking about one of their sponsees, and that's all they talk about, at the end of the conversation, I say, we have reached a milestone. We have reached a milestone. You are talking about somebody else that you now love, that you want to get better, and you have not told me one thing about your problems. And they're like, oh, huh, yeah, guess I did. You know, and they feel really good about themselves. And they should, because we forget about our self-forgetting. You know, the 11-step prayer, self-forgetting is what's going to save me. I don't need more self-absorption. The fourth and fifth steps didn't come that hard to me, and we lose a lot of people at step four. Boy, we lose a lot of people at step four, but they weren't that hard because I'd been journaling away my problems for years. I don't know how many journals I'd filled up with my own misery. So the fourth step, I was like, oh, paper, pen, me, let's do it. You know, so did the fourth step, did the fifth step. Those fifth step promises, they are big in the big book. Wow. Walking hand in hand with our Creator, I think that's a fifth step promise. They didn't quite come true for me, but you know where the power was for me is in step nine. The power was in step nine because I was all talk. I was all talk before. I was a manipulator. I could get you to my side. I could convince you. I could get what I wanted with these words. My family was a very verbal family. I tell you, we could convince words right off the page. So it was about step nine, about actually the demonstration. How many times does that word come up in the big book? They will be impressed by a demonstration. They're not going to be impressed by words anymore. So making an honest list, paying the money back. It took me 6 years to make all my financial amends. I had to borrow money from an old 401k. I had to play the shell game with credit cards where it's like 1-0 interest, one and another 0 interest, one, because I'm trying to learn how to be self-supporting because I've never done that. But I had to get a job. You know, a job actually work. But step nine is really, and we lose a lot of people at step nine too. I just want to, it's just, if you could just see, if I could just see what's on the other side of that brick wall of an amends, that the freedom is on the other side, you know, but we can't do those amends for people, and no one could do them for me. And so I do have an amends story that I like to tell, which is that I had a fake service animal. And this was actually in sobriety. I had a fake service animal. I had a dog. And she was great. She was trained. She came on airplanes with me because I wanted to travel with my dog, not because I had any kind of diagnosis. So I was one of those people. And I was doing it in sobriety. And I was in a big book study with my girls. We've had a long-running big book study, and I still Zoom in every couple weeks. And I had kind of mentioned it afterwards. One of them got in my face, and she said, I'm one of those people that finds people like you. And I'm going to tell you, you need to stop that right now because you're hurting people with disabilities. So I wanted to tell her a few things, but I had just stepped out of a big book study, so I kept my mouth shut. Love and tolerance is our code. I called my sponsor, and I dumped on her, and she said, And my first sponsor was so good at really not telling me what to do, letting me reach my, she gave me just enough rope to hang myself. So the next morning, of course, I woke up and I was like, oh my gosh, what have I done? This is a fake animal. I had gotten like a fake diagnosis. I had fake papers. I was hurting people by bringing my dog on. So I was like, I got to make this right. So the first thing, of course, don't do it again. So then I'm like, how to make this amends? Well, my friend said there's this local chapter called Canine Companions. They train service animals. So I gave them a call. I gave this Atlanta chapter a call, and I said, I'm one of those people. I had to leave a message. No one picked up. I left a message. And I didn't think I'd ever hear it. I said, I'm going to send you a contribution. Like I could get away with a contribution for this amends. I'm going to send you a contribution. I'm so sorry. You know, let me know if there's any other way I can make it right. Because you know how we're trained with amends. It's just you leave all the room to the other person to do the speaking. You let them lead the amends. And so I got a call back. And the woman said, oh, hi. Yeah, there is something you could do for us. There's a producer who wants to make a program about this. And I would like them to talk to you. So it's like, all right. And the way I see it, amends is like a horse you get on, but you don't have any reins. You're just going to go where the horse goes. So the producer called me, and he was like, oh, you sound great. I'm sending a camera crew down to Atlanta next week. So I met a producer and a camera crew in an Atlanta hotel, and I ended up on Good Morning America in 2020. And, you know, it's such a God thing, because after that my sister was like, oh, my God, now you're going to have to, like, go around the country telling this story. But that was it. It was over. I never heard anything else about it. And I was like, the men's is done. It's done. And it was such a God thing. When I was doing the steps, something did happen to me, and I did start to fall in love with God. I realized that one day I was listening to pop music, some love song, and I started to cry, and I realized it wasn't about a person, it was about God. And I thought, whoa, something has happened to me, because I came from an agnostic family, agnostic trending towards atheist, and that's what I was, chasing my other gods. So something happened to me in those steps, and that's what I'm chasing now. There's one thing, I'm always going to be a person that wants more of someone that feels good, and there's only one thing that's safe now. It's only one thing that's safe for me to want more of, and that's God's love. And I connect most closely with God in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did join a church about 6 years in to sobriety because I wanted more God. So I joined, I got baptized and joined a church and got closer to God that way. But I've always felt God most strongly in Alcoholics Anonymous, working with another alcoholic or being in a meeting or listening to the music of AA or just people talking. I've always felt, at home and once the steps got the monkey off my back, and once the steps began to repair my self-esteem brick by brick, because it was very, very low, my self-esteem when I came in. I had squandered a world of opportunity, great education, a great family. I had squandered it all by living an alcoholic life. But brick by brick, AA brings back self-esteem, not self-confidence. I do not have self-confidence, and I don't have faith in myself. I have faith in God, and I have faith in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a big difference to me. The book says once some of us had great self-confidence. I really don't have it. I do feel I'm recovered. There is a little bit of, you know, people talk about that, recovering or recovered. Today I do feel recovered, but I know what could happen if I slip out of the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Before I moved to North Carolina, you know, the pandemic has done many things to Alcoholics Anonymous, and a lot of us didn't, some of us didn't make it through the pandemic, but the Zoom thing has saved a lot of lives. And before I moved to North Carolina, I started going to Zooms in North Carolina. And I found my sponsor on Zoom in North Carolina, and I found a group that ended up being my home group on Zoom. And I just slipped right in. The first meeting I went to, they knew who I was. I'd been on Zoom. And I had a sponsor, a local sponsor, almost immediately. And I tell you, moving takes a lot of people out. And it can happen in very tricky way. I'm so busy. I'm going to the house, got a new job. You know what? I'll wait till I visit my Atlanta friends. I'll wait till I go to that conference back in Georgia. I'm okay. I still got some sponsees in Georgia. What the mind is going to do with alcoholism, I don't feel it today. The obsession's not in my mind today, but it's a hunter, and it's not far. It's not far. I feel like it's just circling this compound right now. What mind can it get into with a little bit of an excuse or a little bit of judgment? I do have a judgmental mind. Whenever I start criticizing someone in Alcoholics Anonymous, I just start laughing because I'm like, okay, God, we're going to be great friends. I know that's going to happen. God always comes in and breaks open my heart if I'm criticizing someone in Alcoholics Anonymous. Not out loud. I've managed not to do that. I have restraint of tongue and pen for the most part. But in here, in this little critique factory, I know that God's going to soften me up, and I'm going to love that person. Even if we're not great friends, I'm going to love that person. So I just start laughing now. Because the Buddhists did teach me that the mind creates thoughts like the liver creates bile. It just happens. That's just what the mind does. And the mind of alcoholism in the mind creates ugly thoughts. Ugly thoughts about me and the world around me. And Alcoholics Anonymous and a relationship with God create beautiful thoughts about myself. I remember the day when I was in recovery and I had done something stupid. And I was looking at myself in the mirror and I was waiting for the ugly voices to come. And instead, a little voice inside said, "Oh, honey, that was so precious what you just did." That doesn't sound like much, but I said, "Oh, something's happened to me. Something's happened in my mind. I'm starting to love myself again. I'm starting to think I've got some value here. I can be helpful." When I went to Asheville, I thought, well, I guess I won't sponsor for a while, because I walked into my home group and everyone had a million years. And I said, well, okay, God, that's fine. I'll do other service. I'll help do a retreat, organize a retreat. I'm going to be the opener. I'll be this. I'll be that. My first meeting there, this woman comes running up to me. She had 30 years of sobriety. And she said, "Will you be my sponsor?" And I started talking her out of it. I was like, "You have 30 years of sobriety." And she said, "You know what, honey, I didn't even know that was going to come out of my mouth. So I guess God has a plan for us." So I thought, okay, all right. And it's just gone on from there. And now I'm taking 3 people through the steps at this point. And somebody said, Polly P maybe, said, you want them blowing up your phone. You want those women calling you. Even if you can't pick it up all the time, you want them because they are inviting you out of your own mind and they're inviting you into God's world. It's a really, really good life. I have a great marriage. I met my wife when I was only 2 months sober, and thank goodness my sponsor didn't say, "Don't date." She said, "That's not in the book." She said, "Just don't make this woman your God." And I did, because we know now what the brain does is on cocaine at the beginning of a relationship. That's what the brain does. So a month in, we took a break, and no, my wife is not an alcoholic. She likes to drink, and she had to come to peace. She had to ask herself, can she be with a sober person? And I had to say, can I put her third after God and after AA? And we came back together after that time, and we were clear. And she said, "I know I'm number 3 for you." And she said, and I said, "And I know you like drinking, and I will be at peace with that." And we came back together, and it has turned into a beautiful marriage. I didn't think it ever could be this easy. I didn't think relationships were easy. And I know for a lot of people they're not. I know they're not. This one is just easy. It's been easy for 10 years. So, and Alcoholics Anonymous taught me that. The friends I have right here, for the girl who couldn't make a friend and keep them, they're my girls, are right here. I have my own little business now. I actually show up. I mean, the boss isn't too bad. It's me. I'm the boss. So I guess some days I am bad. Life is obviously not perfect. There's been loss. My precious mother died, but I got sober before she died, and she said before she died, "I can lean on you." My precious father needs help now. He wanted to hand over the keys to the financial kingdom to me. He wants me to run his finances. Are you sure? Do you know what I've done to your finances? Have you done the math? Like, I'm a big debit. I'm like a capital D debit in this family. But finally, I'm not, you know, I'm healing. Alcoholics Anonymous is healing that too. I didn't become like a financially self-supporting overnight, and it's a long road, you know, but I'm on that road, and we're on that road together. It's a real honor to be here. I want to thank the committee for asking me. It was a surprise phone call to get. I was really, really surprised to get that phone call. It's a lovely phone call to get, and it's an honor. I really asked God to speak through me. I prayed with my friends beforehand. And look, I'm a New Yorker who was like an atheist. Like, you don't pray with your friends beforehand. But that's what you've turned me into, is someone who lovingly prays with their friends before things happen, so that God speaks through me, that I could reach somebody. No one's going to reach everybody. And I'm sure I offended somebody along the way. I mean, every speaker does. But Clancy said something that I really hold true, which is Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking to another. We all know that part. We've heard that part. But I tell you, when I was drunk, I spoke to a lot of alcoholics too. And we weren't getting better together. So it's one alcoholic talking to another one to let her know she's not so different and to convince her to take steps she doesn't yet believe in. And that's what I hope we're doing for each other. Thank you. It's been an honor.